So with permission from the Rabbi Gabi, good evening to everyone. Really thank you all for coming. It's always a pleasure to be in this room on a Wednesday night. A lot changed for many people on these Wednesday nights, so I personally get emotional when I look around the room and I see people that are on the path, beyond the path, continuing Judaism, and it really makes me at least a bit emotional. I needed 2 minutes just to gather myself so I can speak logically and coherently to you, because it's rather emotional to think about many people that started their Jewish paths in this room on a Wednesday night. And to know that, thank God, it worked out, and they're continuing to lead beautiful Jewish lives, and thank God, bringing the next generation as well with them to this beautiful path of Judaism. So it's always difficult to be in this room. If Gabi thinks it comes easy to me, Rabbi, it doesn't. That's number one. Number two, a lot changed for me this past year, and therefore all the lessons and lectures that I've given and I'm going to give this year, I wanted to dedicate to the memory of my father, Tzvi Meir, the son of Moshe Yonatan, Hareini Kaparat Mishkavo. He passed away this past February, so I'd like to dedicate the words of Torah I'll say tonight to his memory. Obviously, the jokes and the Narishkeit and everything else beyond it should not be dedicated to his memory. I take responsibility for that on my own, but obviously the words of Torah to his memory. Where was I for Shabbos? I have to admit, it's amazing. I was in New Zealand, and it's the first place in the world that I know of to accept Shabbos. In other words, Shabbos begins at 4:45 this past Friday in New Zealand, which is a doubleheader for me, because on the one hand, in July, I'm not used to Shabbos beginning at 4:45 p.m. And number two, it's the first place on the map where you can say good Shabbos, and it's really Shabbos. And I'm amazed. I told the rabbi there, you know, Shabbos, that's easy. That's small potatoes. You're the first place to be signed and sealed at the end of Yom Kippur. When you daven ne'ilah, that final prayer on Yom Kippur, that's it. It's up to you. The whole world is on your shoulders. In other words, Seattle, they don't care. They're already past. Let's think about this. New Zealand, Australia, Europe, Israel, not to mention New York and other places on the eastern coast of America. But New Zealand, that's it. That's where it begins and ends. So that was the first possible place to accept Shabbos, say goodbye to Shabbos. It was my first visit there. So it was actually very, very nice, thank God. The two rabbis in New Zealand are graduates of our program, and it was wonderful to visit with them, Rabbi Tal and Rabbi Friedler, and it's wonderful to see their communities and equate them to communities in Australia, because it's amazing how you're so close and that there's different cultures, and really shuls work differently, people are different, and it's an amazing study in sociology, not to mention the fact it's a study in what Jews talk about at Kiddush. Really different. Totally and utterly different. And on that happy note, everyone here knows me? Is there anyone here that never met me before? Like, doesn't know me from a hole in the head? Stranger coming in. Okay, so you all know me, and you know that when I come here, I usually wear a suit and tie, and I stand out like a thorn in a beautiful tree, because no one wears a suit and tie here. So, with your permission, can I take off this jacket? Yeah. Thank you very, very much.
And the tie.
The tie, that's too much to ask there. Jeff, you know, you can't convert someone overnight. There's a process here. I spoke to the rabbi, and he wanted me to speak a bit about what indeed should be the investment for the future of the people of the Ark. Should they invest in this building, namely in the shul, or should they invest in their Jewish homes? Or if I can put it another way, if you have to go ahead and decide that, hey, I want to be Jewish, and I want to be very Jewish for that matter, and I want to put Judaism on my personal agenda, where should I spend the majority of my time? Should I spend it in synagogue, or should I spend it at home? Should I invest in making a Jewish synagogue, or should I invest in making a Jewish home? Now, we all know the answer is what? Those that know my style know I do not ask theoretical questions. Those that don't, this is not a theoretical question. So, the answer, of course, is what?
It's also home. The answer is what?
Which?
Yeah.
Answer is both. This is not an either or. We're not talking about you only have enough money to buy Shabbos candles versus Hanukkah candles? Which one takes precedence? That's a hard question. The Gemara talks about it. That's a question we'll deal with some other time. We're talking about a normative situation in which we have time to invest and we have to allocate our time. So part of our time we go to work in order to make money. Now we go home and we go to shul. That's where we are. The question is, where should we spend the majority of our time? Should we spend it at home or should we spend it at shul? Now, if I was giving this lecture in Israel right now, in certain circles, I'd be arrested for defamation of airspace. Can anyone tell me why?
Because he didn't ask his wife.
I didn't what?
Didn't ask your wife whether you should spend more time at home or more time at shul.
Didn't think of that, but you're right.
You remember that for the next time.
Very, very good. There's another reason. In certain places in Israel today, there's a very, very big debate. Should we invest in yeshiva boys learning full-time and not going to the army? Which is another way of saying, should we invest in the elite that will spend the majority of their lives in the study hall and not working and contributing to the society of Israel in that form? No, their contribution will be via learning and developing their minds and developing, obviously, novel ideas of Torah for the next generation. So that's the debate I don't want to get into this evening. I'm talking about people that work for a living, come home, go to shul, and the question is, where does God want us to put the majority of our investment Jewishly? And in order to answer this question, I ultimately want to start, like any Jew, by answering a question with a question. And this is not my question, this is Victor's question. Victor was my president when I was a rabbi for 3 out of my 4 years. Victor came to Minyan every day for Mincha and Ma'ariv. And Victor loved coming to Minyan during the week. It was a respite. He had businesses. It was a half an hour where he rested. And one day I'm talking about, I don't remember what, and he said, Rabbi, I got a question. It's quoted here word for word from a book that I edited recently and wrote called Beyond Routine. And in that book, on the chapter on Shavuos, I quote Victor word for word, letter for letter, without his name, of course, because I didn't get his permission. But he said like this, Rabbi, you've been teaching us about washing your hands, and you've been teaching us about what bracha you make on this, and what do you do over there, and what happens, when do you put up a mezuzah, how big does the room have to be, all the intricacies of Jewish law that make a good debate between Mincha and Ma'ariv and keep the people awake. So with the help of Jackie Mason and a few jokes and some Torah, you've done it. Rabbi, I have a very simple question for you. There's 8 days of Pesach. How many days of Sukkot?
9.
How come Shavuos only gets 1 measly day in Israel? Outside of Israel, how many days?
2.
Imagine the holiday to which we owe all the rest. The holiday that we got from God on the Mount Sinai, Pesach, Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, fasting on Yom Kippur, the high prices we pay for kosher meat, not to mention the fact that we need to make contributions to, name it, the shul, JNF, KKL, and onwards, and all because of Mount Sinai. And that day gets 1 day, 2 days, finished. But Sukkot, 9 days. 9 days after you had a Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Pesach! 8 days of constipation. Wonderful. All of it, the entire 612 mitzvot, go back, he said, to that Mount Sinai. So how come we don't have 21 days of Shavuos? How come it's only 2? At the time, I gave him an honest-to-goodness answer, which was, and I still believe in it, Victor, I wasn't on the editorial board of the Torah. God didn't consult me. Had he consulted me, I may have brought up your point. But I wasn't there. I really don't know. I can tell you what the Torah says. I really don't know the reasons for it. And I wrote an entire book this past year, and I have to be honest with you, I tried to give meaning and significance to all the mitzvot we do on the Shabbos and the holidays of the year. I didn't give reasons. And in my introduction, whoever bothers to read introductions to about 2 people on earth, I write, I am not giving reasons, because I don't know the reasons. I wasn't on the editorial board of the Torah. That's the end of the lecture. Whoever wants to leave now, that's it. But if I want to now say, okay, once God gave it to us, can I learn something from it? You know, once there's a reality on the ground, what can I learn from it? You know, if you have a delay on the plane, you know the reason. You learn from it for future reference. Like if you have a delay on a Friday and you missed, you come in and it's Shabbos and you have to break your head, can I leave the airport or not? You make sure not to fly on Friday. So what can I learn from the fact? There's only 2 days of Shavuos versus Pesach getting 8 days, Sukkot getting 9 days, Rosh Hashanah getting 2 days, as well as Shavuos, but ultimately, it seems like Shavuos is shortchanged. And it's the holiday that we got it all. I mean, literally, the kosher food in the kitchen, the way a synagogue looks, anything you see in this building goes back to Shavuos, and it gets 2 days in and out. If you look at this first source on the page, you'll see that I thought that people around here would think I'm faking it. So, not only does Shavuos get 2 days, but there's no name to the holiday. You know, every holiday has a name in the Torah. We may call it whatever name we'd like, but in the Torah, it has a name. So, what is Pesach called in the Torah? And it's not a trick question. Don't say Pesach. Don't say what?
Chodesh HaRishon.
Okay, Chodesh HaRishon is the month in which Pesach happens, correct? That is another name for the month of Nisan. But what's Pesach called? The holiday. So, Erev Pesach is the time when you brought the Pesach sacrifice. That's called Pesach in the biblical Torah. Now, that's Pesach. Now, what we call Pesach, the 8-day holiday, is called Chag HaMatzot. It's in bolded letters on the second line. Uvachamisha sayom lachodesh hazen, on the 15th day of the month, Chag HaMatzot LaHashem. Now, Sukkot has a name. What's the name of Sukkot in the Torah? Wild guess. Sukkot. Look at the bottom. Uvechamisha asayom lachodesh hashvi'i hazeh chag hasukkot shivat yamim la'ashem. 7 days you sit in the sukkah, then you have Shmini Atzeret, the 8th day, the 9th day outside of Israel. Great. Look in the middle there, Shavuos, where it says Shavuot in Hebrew. It's 2 lines. Uspartem lachem imocharat haShabbat. And you start counting from the day after the first day of what we colloquially call Pesach. What do we count? The Omer. And you count for how many days? 49. And on the 50th day is? I quote, Ukra'atem be'etzem ayom hazeh, you shall call it on that day, Mikra Kodesh yelachem, a holy day it should do, kol melechet avodah lo ta'asu, don't do any creative labor outside of cooking and carrying and transferring a match. What's missing here? Name. I understand it's a holiday. I understand when it is. That's 49 days after the first day of Pesach, namely the 50th day. I know what you have to do. I just don't know what it's called. It's like, I'm going to give you a girl, a wonderful girl. You should go on a date with this girl. What's her name? She's lovely. She looks great. What's her name? She comes from a great family. What's her name? The Torah doesn't give a name to Shavuos. It says it's on the 50th day after the first day of what we call Pesach. The Rambam, going ahead and codifying Jewish law, the Rambam, Maimonides, had a great idea, and great ideas sometimes work, and that is, he's going to write 14 books of the Code of Jewish Law, and every library around the world will have basically 15 books. The Bible, 24 books of the Bible, plus the 14 books of the Rambam, that's it. You could save a lot of money and a lot of shelf space. That's what the Rambam set out to do. He didn't succeed. But still, a code of Jewish law it is. The Rambam is quoted and requoted, and endless books were written on it. So let's quote the laws of Yom Tov in the Rambam. Chapter 6, says the Rambam, subdivision 17. Everybody ready? It is forbidden to fast or recite eulogies on the 7 days of Pesach, the 8 days of Sukkot, and... anyone? The other holidays. What are the holidays? So when I read it, I said, oh, there are other holidays. There's Rosh Hashanah, there's Yom Kippur. He actually talks about that in a different place, so it can't be Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. What's the other holidays? Only one left. Shavuot. So the Rambam, being true to the laws of the Torah, says the Torah doesn't give it a name. In my code of Jewish law, a nameless holiday, Sukkot, Pesach, and the other nameless holiday, this is what you can't do. No eulogies, no fasting, got it. Okay, so Shavuos has no name. So it's shortchanged by days, only 2 days, outside of Israel, and it has no name. No name. The nameless holiday. Let's go on. The Shavuos have a unique mitzvah that you only do on Shavuos that you do not do any other time during the year. Cheesecake. Who said cheesecake? Okay, someone behind you. Mrs. Mandel, cheesecake, you should know, is a great custom on Shavuot. It's a wonderful custom. It is an impetus for many people, a catalyst, to count the Omer. In Israel, the law of many mothers are, if you don't finish the 49 days of counting the Omer, you do not get cheesecake on Shavuot. And you should know many people fall for it. That like dairy. However, if you're a cannibal like me, you don't fall for that one. But cheesecake is a custom. Now, let's go through the holidays. Does Pesach have a unique mitzvah not done in any other holiday? You name it. Let's go through the Seder. Do you ever drink 4 cups of wine obligatory? You can, but you don't have to. Seder night. You ever have a mitzvah to eat matzah? Like a positive commandment, you're celiac, whatever. You have to eat the matzah? Seder night. Seder nights? Yes. You can go on and on. All the Seder night mitzvah special only on Pesach. And what's the overarching mitzvah of Pesach that makes us crazy before Pesach and after Pesach? No leavened products. That's only Pesach. Now let's go on. Rosh Hashanah. Is there a mitzvah in Rosh Hashanah that makes and breaks it for many rabbis? I mean, like this is, I always say in Israel, they say, how do you know if the guy that you're marrying is really masculine? If he breaks the glass. If he can't break the glass at the wedding, he's really not a man. That's what they say. Don't take it to heart. Believe me, it's a bunch of... It's made up by someone. But you should know I had a guy who I married, handicapped, in a wheelchair, no halachic problem. And I told him, no problem. Obviously, you'll break the glass by just throwing it on the floor. You have to break it with your foot. There's no halacha like that. I said, no. In my family, a Moroccan family, I don't break the glass, they're not going to think I'm a man. So he went to physical therapy to be able to do one thing, to stand up and break a glass. Amazing, right? What a Jewish custom can do. And he broke it on the first shot. Wasn't a dry eye in the... Everyone there said, he's a man. It was amazing. Anyway, to make a long story short, you come to the holiday of Rosh Hashanah. This makes and breaks it for rabbis. Many people say, if you can't do this, you're not a rabbi. And what am I talking about? You have to hear the shofar. That's easy. You got 2 ears. What's the harder part, Ann? Blowing the shofar is hard for many people. That's a unique mitzvah on Rosh Hashanah. If you look at the chart in the bottom of page, on the bottom of the page, you can see that, indeed, on Erev Pesach, on the eve of Pesach, there's a special mitzvah to bring the Pesach sacrifice. On Pesach, we have a mitzvah to eat matzah and to stay away from chametz, from leavened products. On Sukkot, we have a mitzvah to live in the sukkah and to take the 4 species biblically on the first and second day and for the rest of the holiday rabbinically. What's the mitzvah of Sukkot? I just said it. What's the mitzvah of Shavuot? Holiday of giving the Torah. What's the mitzvah? Take a look. Chart. Look where it's empty. You see it says nothing. Historic reason. Nothing. Ve'asita chag Shavuot la'Hashem Elokechem. The book of Devarim as opposed to the book of Vayikra, there is a name of Shavuot. It's called chag Shavuot. Thank God. What do? You make a holiday of Shavuot. Okay. So I know. A holiday, we got a protocol, what we're allowed to do. Right? 36 things we can't do, 3 things we can do, we got a daven, I got it. But there's always a special mitzvah. That's the second page. Rosh Hashanah, shofar. Yom Kippur, fasting, and all the rest of their prohibitions. Sukkot, living in the sukkah, and shaking the 4 species. Pesach, matzah, and no chametz. Shavuos. Now, Mrs. Mandel says cheesecakes and milchiks and many of the customs of Shavuos is to fill in this blank thing on the page here. Because there is no biblical mitzvah on Shavuot. So Shavuot is only 2 days. It has no name when the Torah gives names. It has absolutely no specific mitzvah. Nothing. So the holiday to which we owe all the laws of the Torah, you could have missed. Literally, you could have passed over, not a pun. You could have passed over it because it's hidden. There's no name, it's only 2 days, and there's no mitzvah. If you turn the page, please, you'll see that in my humble opinion, I believe that this is on purpose. And why is it on purpose? The truth is that if we would have made a big deal about Shavuos, there would have been a price. And what's the price? If you look down where it says answer, I believe that if you would have made a big deal about Shavuos, like you make a big deal about the sukkah, and a big deal about the matzah, what would have happened?
You're belittling the Torah.
You're belittling the Torah. How?
I'm making something more important than the Torah.
For 8 days, 7 days. In other words, if we would have gone ahead and said, Shavuot is the holiday of the giving of the Torah, and you have to celebrate it by learning Torah, then you would have said, no problem. 2 days a year, that's what I'll do. And then, like the Pesach dishes, I'll put it away, I'll maybe give it a kiss, very nice, and I'll never look at it for the rest of the year. God told us, with regard to matzah, 7 days, 8 days, good enough. You don't need to look at it, taste it, for the rest of the year. Sukkot, important, for how long? 7 days or 8 days of the year, that's it. Good. Rosh Hashanah, shofar, using your two ears and not your big mouth, 2 days, good. Fasting, biblically, is one biblical fast, Yom Kippur, that's it. All the rest are rabbinic, minus, etc. But learning Torah, living Torah, keeping the Torah, if we would have given it as a mitzvah, it would have been perhaps limited to 2 days a year only. I think it would. Let's look at the next source. It says in Devarim, Perek Kavav, Pasuk Tet Zayin, Hayom Azeh, this day, Hashem Elokecha, the Lord your God, Mitzavcha La'asot Tachukim Ha'ela Ve'et HaMishpatim. God has commanded you to do these mitzvot. Rashi says, what do you mean, this day? When was this verse said? If you say the book of Devarim, that's the last book of the Torah. Moshe is giving his last speech on earth. This is the 40th year they're in the desert. Moshe's about to die. When did they get the Torah? Mount Sinai. How many years prior?
Quite a number.
I just said it. 40 years ago. On this day. What do you mean on this day? If my birthday was on this day I was born. What do you mean on this day? 40 something years ago when you used to have hair you were born. So Moshe Rabbeinu in the Holy Torah, Moshe our teacher said, on this day. Rashi says, "Bechol yom yiyu be'inecha chadashim ki ilu bayom bo bayom nitztaveta alehem." Rashi says, and I quote, "Every day it shall be in your eyes as if it's new, as if that very day you were commanded to do them." So when Moshe says in his final speech, "On this day I give you the Torah," he's not saying, "I gave you the Torah historically today." It's not the birthday of the Torah, but rather he's saying, "Every day, be it the 6th of Nisan, the 7th of Sivan, the 8th of Tammuz, whatever day you want to pick, December 25th, June 1st, or January 1st, the Torah is relevant." And let's think about this a second. Is it relevant? Matzah is not relevant till next Pesach. Sukkot is not relevant till Sukkot time. Is the Torah relevant this evening? What's the proof of that? The fact that we're here. Sarah just said it beautifully. The fact that we're sitting and learning Torah tonight. We didn't get to Torah tonight. But the fact that we're even talking about it is the proof that Shavuos works. If God would have made a big deal about it, said for 2 days a year, make a big deal, you would have put it away like the Pesach dishes or what you do with your schach for Sukkot. Gone, don't look at it till next year. Then you take it out, you dust it off, you love it for 7 days, and then you can't stand it because going in from the rain, no rain, yes rain, thank God I'm finished with this. But once a year we're excited. God said you can live with the sukkah once a year, I'm okay with that. You can live with the matzah once a year, I'm okay with it. You get drunk on wine, you wake up the next morning with a terrible, terrible headache for some mysterious reason, fine, once a year. I'm okay with that. There's one thing that's an exception. And what's that? The Torah. The Torah is relevant tonight as much as it was yesterday and as much as it was on Shavuos. And let's think about what we did tonight. We came into this building. There's a mezuzah on every door. We drink water and other beverages as well as food that's kosher. We go ahead and conduct our business honestly. There isn't one point in the day in which we're not either learning Torah, like we're doing now, or fulfilling the Torah in work, in the road, as we drive. Anywhere you look, we're fulfilling mitzvot. Therefore, God said, if God forbid, so to speak, I would have gone ahead and given you a big, long holiday for Torah, you would have made a big deal about it for a few days a year. I want it, like Moshe says, to be as if it was given today. And therefore, indeed, comes a beautiful medrash and says, and I quote, the medrash says, our sages say, the Torah should be dear to you every day, as if today was given anew for that day. And indeed, throughout our literature, we find that constantly the sages and God are telling us, every day, wherever you are, the Torah is relevant. You're either learning it or fulfilling it. There's no such thing as the Torah being devoid of the Jewish people. For example, and Rabbi Yehuda opened the discussion in honor of the Torah, second to last source on the page from Tractate Brachot, and said, pay attention and listen, O Israel. This day you have become a nation. Did the people just receive the Torah that day? After all, they received it 40 years prior. Rather, to teach you, the Torah is so dear to the Jewish people that you learn it every single day as if it was received at Sinai. Namely, our sages said, you can say any day of the year, today I received the Torah. Why? Because either you're learning it or, let's see if you're listening.
Practicing, fulfilling it.
There's no such thing as a day that goes by without. Let's think about it. You're going to leave this class. You go into your car and you drive safely. That is a mitzvah of the Torah called Ushmartem Me'od Lenafshoteichem, and you shall be careful with your health. And amongst it, you shall be careful not to be put in danger. Then you go home, you say hello to your wife, your husband, your kids. That's a mitzvah called Havei Mekabel Kol Adam B'Sefer Panim Yafod. You shall look at everyone and say hello to them with a big smile on. Be it a Jew, a non-Jew, whatever it might be. And obviously your own children and your wife and your husband and whatnot. You wake up in the morning, you say, Modeh Ani Lefanecha. Thank you, God, for giving back my soul. There isn't a point in the day, being it honest in business at the office, the way you treat your workers, and be it at home, where you're not fulfilling the Torah or learning the Torah. And therefore, every single day, we say the Shema, and we say these words. Part of the Shema is, Asher Anochi Mitzavecha Hayom Al Levavecha. And these words shall be on your heart today. Again, the word today. Says the Shulchan Aruch, this is the code of Jewish law now, that I have commanded you today, is to say, each day, it should be in your eyes like something new. And like one who has heard it many times and it's no longer cherished. And we, every day, when you say the Shema, or you talk about the words of the Torah, it's like you just received it. And therefore, if I'm correct, now you understand why Shavuos is just 1 or 2 days. If not, it would have been limited to 1 or 2 days. It wouldn't be relevant tonight. And why is Shavuos hidden in the Torah? No name, barely a date. Because God said, listen, Shavuos is the anniversary of a marriage of the entire year. Now, if you're married the entire year, I hope that A, you remember your anniversary. If not, you won't have many anniversaries to celebrate. And B, you have what to celebrate. But if you're not married all year, what are you celebrating on your anniversary? What are you celebrating? If you live apart all year and you come together on your anniversary, oh, nice to see you. What have you been doing this year? You know, it's great. That might be a good recipe for a good marriage. Don't be married, just on paper. You'll never have a quarrel. You'll never have an argument. Sounds good. But guess what? You won't be able to celebrate an anniversary. Because what are you celebrating? Nothing. We are married to the Torah all year. And once a year, yes, we have a celebration of an anniversary. 1 day or 2 days. That's it. But if you're not married to it all year, you have nothing to celebrate. Therefore, there's no mitzvah on Shavuos, as Rav Kasher says. Rav Kasher was a very kosher rabbi. That's why his name is Rav Kasher, Rabbi Kosher. He knew everything. He had an encyclopedic memory. He wrote an interpretation on the biblical Torah with every single possible words of our sages that were ever written on every verse. It's called Torah Shlema, the full Torah. You know why it's called the full Torah? There isn't one interpretation not in there.
Now, because he had a photographic memory, when he died, so did that particular idea, because no one has his memory. But thank God he got through the second book of the Torah, Shmot, and he writes about Shavuos, and I quote, "Mipnei godel kedushat hayom bo nitna kol haTorah kula, lo ratzu laktin kedushata yidei mitzvah pratit." Because of the greatness of the Day of Holiness, namely, the entire Torah was given on Shavuos, God didn't want to belittle its holiness. Who said that before? I think it was Michael. Maybe Jeff. Excuse me, Jeff. Didn't want to belittle its holiness by having just a specific mitzvah. If you would have said, Shavuos, learn Torah, you would have belittled the Torah to one day. In order not to do that, God didn't give a mitzvah on Shavuos. Shavuos is a celebration of the entire Torah. You pick it, you can do it. And indeed, we fulfill it. We have this custom to stay up the whole night of Shavuos. Again, to fill in the blanks with the cheesecake. What do we talk about in the night of Shavuos? What's the theme? In every shul in the world, what's the theme? So if you'd have asked me, I just came to Judaism, welcome. I would have said the Ten Commandments, because we were going to read about it the next day. Michael's not totally off. Any shul can talk about any one of the 613 mitzvot, and they're good. But see, Michael, you're not totally off. I'll explain why. Have you heard of Rav Saadia Gaon? Just say yes. No one knows. Okay. People ask me that question. I say, sure. Rav Saadia Gaon, he was someone... Rav Saadia Gaon lived in the 10th century, 9th century perhaps. He was part of the period where they wrote beautiful additions to the service, called Piyutim. We usually only have them today in most Ashkenazi shuls, also here in the Ark, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Right? We add things to the service. That's called Piyutim, poems. Right? You know some of them, right? Unetane Tokev, I'll throw out names. V'chol Ma'aminim, any of these things mean anything to anyone here? Hayom, 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 right? Those are additions to the regular service. Now, he wrote a poem for Shavuos. They used to have these additions on all the holidays. So Rav Saadia Gaon took Michael's idea to its logical conclusions. He says, how come on Shavuos, which is a celebration of getting the entire Torah, we only read about the Ten Commandments? After all, that's 10 out of 613. It must be, says Rav Saadia Gaon, that the entire Torah can be divided into, take a wild guess, 10 categories. So what did he do? He took the 613 commandments. He put a piece of paper, probably he put it this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. On the top he put the commandment, and he said, what can be subsumed under this commandment? So let's do a little trick, okay? One of the 10 commandments is, remember the Sabbath day to make it holy. What do you think he put in there? Obviously the laws of Shabbat. What else? What's like Shabbat? Similar? Yom Tov, so they got Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Pesach, Shavuot, all under that category, right? Different, similar, pretty similar, very good. Then it says, you shall not murder. What could be put under that category? Well, murder means killing someone, okay, that's pretty straightforward. What about not killing someone actively but passively? You know, they're connected to a respirator, you just walk by and you like take out the plug. That's pretty much murder, right? But it was a question. Everyone headed in hard there. Now, what happens if the respirator is going to go out by itself? You have to switch the gas tank. Just make sure not to be there at the moment that the gas tank has to be switched. That's not murder. That's basically not saving a life. That was put in there too. Anything that has to do with ending a life, okay? Organ donations. If he was alive and there was organ donations, I'm sure it would be put in there. Because if you decide that you need to have brain death in order to be dead, then you can give organs. If you say it's brain death plus heart, there's no organ donation. So the whole debate about organ donations was put into thou shalt not murder, right? Let's go on. It's thou shalt not steal. Pretty straightforward, right? Don't steal my phone. Got it. What can be put in there?
Dealing honestly in business.
Standing on dishonestly in businesses, and what else?
Adultery.
Adultery? That's another commandment, actually.
So you should not steal your neighbor's wife.
That's true. But that happens to be an independent commandment. All right, you understand what he did? Everyone got it? He took 10 categories. He wrote a poem for Shavuot. They said it during davening. It took about 5 minutes, maybe. That was it. Now you fast forward. This is 10th century. In the 20th century, there was a great rabbi, Rabbi Yerucham Perla. Rabbi Yerucham Perla, he decided, we got a beautiful treasure here. Wow, Rabbi Gabi, this is all the 613 mitzvot, all written. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write an interpretation on it so people understand it. So from a three-page poem came three volumes. Rav Yerucham Perlez, he so calls it Rav Saadya's Gaon's List of Mitzvot. He wrote three pages of Saadya Gaon. In the 20th century, three pages turned into three volumes. So what Michael said was totally right. Ten commandments, but ten commandments are the ten categories of the entire Torah. By the way, he wasn't the only one. Many have said the ten commandments are the subcategories of the entire Torah, but he was the one that actually put it into writing. So, that's a good commercial break. When you take something small, you make it big. Very indicative of the 20th century. There used to be small transistor radios. They made boom boxes. Small little poem. Three volume set. Okay. Getting back to our story here, there's no mitzvah. Correct. Now you got the whole Torah in this. It's a beautiful Talmudic passage. I said, Ashrei mishabalakan v'talmudo biyado. Blessed is the person that comes to the world to come, passes away, and remembers his learning or her learning. Today we can do it in life. Ashrei mishabalakan, blessed is the person who's holding his learning in his hands. You know what you got in this phone? You got all the Torah, the whole Talmud, the Mishnah, the Gemara, anything you want. It's in my hand. Now, indeed, getting back to our story, maybe this is the reason why Mount Sinai has absolutely no sanctity today whatsoever. There are two mountains that are important to us in Judaism. One is Mount Sinai. What's the second? A lot of fights about it in this 20th, 21st century. Pardon? Mount of Olives, close. The Mount of Olives is a cemetery today. So, not exactly a place you want to hang out.
Is it Mount Ararat, where the Ark came down?
Mount Ararat, I didn't think of that. That's where the Ark came down after the flood, but we don't really know where it is. But okay, an important mountain it is. But for Judaism, we got a very important one. Which one, Gavin? Temple Mount. Wow. Fights about the for us it's a Temple Mount, for another religion it's also pretty important. A lot of fights up there. Now, the Temple Mount, does it have sanctity? 100,000%. The law has been codified that the Temple Mount, even though there's no temple, has sanctity. You can't just go up there when you come to Israel, you know. I'm going to go to Israel, I'm going to visit the beach, I'm going to visit the Holy Wailing Wall, then I'm going to go to Temple Mount and say, how you doing? You got to go up to Temple Mount. You know what you got to do? First you got to immerse in a mikvah. Then you got to put on non-leather shoes. Then you only can go in certain areas. It has sanctity today. Now, let's take that same story. We're in our tour of Israel. So we go up to the Temple Mount, sanctity, only certain areas. We pray there'll be a temple again. Amen. We move on. We go down to the Sinai Desert. The Egyptians let us in. We come into the Sinai Desert. We found Mount Sinai. Pretty important. We just saw 25 places where it says, it's like you gave it at Sinai, it's like Sinai. Oh, Sinai's important. Tell me, can you go up to Mount Sinai and just say, how you doing? Answer. Look on the page. Don't look at me, look at what the sources say. Says the Torah reading on the first day of Shavuos. You all read it. Lo tigah bo yad. When God is on the mountain, don't touch it. Whoever touches the mountain will be killed instantly. But when you hear the last shofar blown, you can go up the mountain. Namely, picture it, the Jews got out of Egypt, 10 plagues, they finally got to the Sea of Reeds, split, 49 days later, all finished, they're at Mount Sinai, can't touch it, thunder, lightning, shofar blowing, Steven Spielberg can't pull this one off, amazing, can't touch the mountain. God says, as soon as you hear the last shofar blow, I'm out of the mountain. You can go up to the mountain, get your kids up there. You make a little playground. Enjoy yourself. As a matter of fact, you do what Jews do best. After they hear a good sermon, you'll probably complain. And you can do it on Mount Sinai. Says the Pasuk, the minute the last shofar blowing was said on that historic day, there's no sanctity to the mountain. And if you don't believe me, thinking I'm crazy, let's look at what the sages say. Tractate Ta'anit, page 12b. As we've seen at Mount Sinai, at the time that God's presence rested on it, the Torah says even the cattle should not gaze near the mountain. But once God's presence left it, the Torah said, when the ram's horn sounds a long, drawn-out blast, they may ascend the mountain. Believe me? Don't believe me? Mount Sinai today has absolute no sanctity. As a matter of fact, after the Six-Day War, when the Jewish people got back both the Kotel, the Temple Mount, and Mount Sinai, Rav Goren, who was the chief rabbi of the army, decided that he's going to make a big ceremony. He's going to start writing a Sefer Torah on Mount Sinai. And he brought, as Rav Goren knew how to do, he bought cameras, again, 1967 footage, but cameras. He thought it's going to be a big deal. Nothing came out of it. You know why? The Jewish people learned Temple Mount, holy. Mount Sinai? None. Why is there no holiness at Mount Sinai? The whole Torah was given at Mount Sinai. The laws that govern the Temple Mount were given on Mount Sinai. How come it doesn't get any credit? That's like saying that the vice president is more important than the president. Doesn't make sense. According to what we said here this evening, it makes perfect sense. If we would have said, oh, the holy mountain can't go near it, then what would happen? God forbid, the Jewish people would have left the Torah on Mount Sinai. And once a year they would have come and looked at it and touched it and gave it a kiss and said, holy, holy this is, and take off their shoes and were very, very holy and sanctified. And then what would they do right after Shavuos? They would have said what that wonderful Jew said who comes to shul once a year on Yom Kippur. As he walks out of shul on Yom Kippur night after it's all over, Ne'ilah's finished, Shofar, bye-bye God, see you next year. That's what would have happened to the Torah. Therefore God said, no sanctity to Mount Sinai. I don't want you to leave the Torah on Mount Sinai. You know what I want you to do with it? What does God tell us right after Mount Sinai? He says, go home. As a matter of fact, it's one of the psukim in the Torah. No one understands. When Moshe recounts in the book of Devarim what happened at Mount Sinai, we're going to read it a week after Tisha B'Av in the Parsha, he says that right after Sinai was over, God said, Lechem mor lahem, God said to Moshe, go tell them, Shuvu lachem le'ohal lechem, go back to your tents. Now let me ask you a question. Did anyone in this synagogue ever say after the Friday night service, ladies and gentlemen, the service is over. Go home.
No.
No, I hope not.
Come tomorrow morning.
Rabbi Gabi, you ever say that? Ever announce? No? Lisa? No? Never? I said, go home? That's like saying, get out of here. Not nice. God said to the Jewish people, go home. Which is another way of saying, get out of here. And he said to Moshe, you have to stand here, you have to receive all the details. But you guys go home. Now why did he tell them to go home? Not nice.
Isn't there a bit missing in that story?
No, that's exactly what it says.
No, I mean a little bit before that.
No?
When Moshe comes down with the tablets,
the
people are told to build an ark, and the Ark of the Covenant.
That's later on, during the fact that after the sin of the golden calf. This is right at the event itself. We're talking about Shavuos before the sin of the golden calf. This is before the Jewish people sinned. So when the Jewish people were still pure, they didn't sin yet. They just got the Torah. They didn't yet shecht an animal because they didn't know how. They're eating milchiks, perhaps. Then God says, go home. And he says to Moshe, you stay here, get the details. Why did God tell him to go home? It wasn't a good piece of advice. God giving us a piece of advice. Listen, the event's over. Why don't you go home, take a nap, go to sleep, have a good night. See you in the morning. God was saying to the Jewish people, go home, because that is where is going to be the true test of the Torah. Will you leave it at Mount Sinai, or will you take it home with you and plug it into everything you do? Namely, the way you run your kitchen, kosher or not kosher. The way you eat your food, a bracha before, a bracha after, avoid of it. The way you conduct business, honest or dishonest. The way you drive. The way you honor a Jewish home. Is this on the door or not? That's the test. The test is not if in synagogue you act properly, but you act properly at home when no one's looking. That's what God was saying, go home. He wasn't saying, get out of here, I don't want to see you again. He's saying, let's see you take what I just taught and plug it into everything you do. Will you succeed or not? And therefore, if you didn't believe anything I just said, look on the bottom of the page where it says go home, comes a beautiful difference of opinion in the Gemara between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua in Tractate Shabbat. This is one of the most beautiful differences of opinion, that if you forgot everything I said tonight, which is fine, nothing I said was important enough, remember this. Everyone wake up now and listen. Rabbi Yehoshua, beautiful name, no prejudice there, and Rabbi Eliezer have the following difference of opinion. Everyone agrees on the holidays and all that fast, but you have to have lavish meals, or can you stay in synagogue all day, eat potato chips, and learn Torah, and daven to God? So Pesach comes, Shavuos comes, Sukkot comes, Rosh Hashanah, all those holidays that we're not allowed to fast, are on those holidays, can you basically stay in shul all day? Eat potato chips, not have lavish meals? But do you have to have a lavish meal at home with the family and cook and everything that goes with it, the cleaning the dishes, the setting out the dishes? Actually, it's the opposite. It's setting out the dishes and then cleaning the dishes. Nope. Comes along, Rabbi Eliezer, and says, O kulo la'Hashem, O kulo lachem. You decide. If you want to devote a day entirely to God, stay in shul all day. So don't lock the Ark Center. Make sure it's open for those that want to stay here all day. And if you want to go home and eat, go. You decide. No problem. Rabbi Yehoshua says, no. Chetziolach la'Hashem, chetziolachem. Divide the day into half. Part of the day for davening, learning. Part of the day for eating. Okay, difference of opinion. It's not the time now to analyze it. What happens on Shavuos? So if you would have asked me at 2 o'clock in the morning, is there a difference of opinion on Shavuos how to celebrate the day? Can you spend the whole day learning, the whole day eating, or divide it half-half? I would have said, nah, Shavuos, everyone agrees, you should learn Torah all day. But that's the day, we got the Torah. Guess what the Gemara says? I got to sit down for this one. Says Rabbi Eliezer, on Shavuot, Rabbi Eliezer says, all agree, he's the one that says you can spend the whole day learning. He says, on Shavuot, all agree, you must also ensure it be for yourselves, namely have a lavish meal. Why? It's the day the Torah was given. In Hebrew, we call this higayon b'shigaon. I can't say that in English. It doesn't rhyme. It's like you want to give something logical, it sounds so stupid, you don't understand the word you just said. The day the Torah was given, it's obvious you have to go home and have a meal. What? The day the Torah was given is the day you can learn it all day. I understand. Makes sense. No. The day the Torah was given, you must have a meal. That's what the Gemara says. So if you want to spend the whole Rosh Hashanah in shul, a few potato chips, make kiddush, Rabbi Eliezer says you're all right. Rabbi Yehoshua doesn't like the idea. Fine. You want to spend Sukkot just learning Torah, maybe you have to do it in the sukkah. Okay? Don't have a lavish meal. Shavuos, you better have a motzi, kiddush, a meal. Why? What's the reason?
It's a celebration.
The Torah was given. If the Torah was given, learn it. Kiss it. Adore it. Like we're doing now. So we're not fasting, we're drinking. We're not eating. That's what we should do, all Shavuos. Have it all night, all day. That's it. Either you sleep, or you learn Torah, or you daven. That's it. That's Shavuos for you. Says the Gemara, absolutely forbidden. If you do this, on Yom Kippur, you're about to stand before God. 44 times I did this. I'm sorry. 45th, I'm sorry, God. I learned Torah all of Shavuos. I shouldn't have done that. I should have eaten a big meal. As you're fasting on Yom Kippur, this is one of the things you didn't do. Anyone understand that? The day the Torah was given is the day you're supposed to eat. Based on what we said, it makes perfect sense. Says Rashi on the Gemara, "Sheyismachmo b'machal v'mishneh l'harot shenochu mekubal yom zeh liYisrael shenitna Torah bo." One should rejoice with it with food and drink in order to show that it was convenient and acceptable that the Torah was given. Can anyone explain those words? Convenient and acceptable that the Torah was given? Okay, let's put it another way. How do you show that the Torah is inconvenient and unacceptable?
By ignoring it.
So you go home, and you basically say, I can't take this holy Torah into my house. What am I supposed to do? Kosher my kitchen? What do you want me to do? You want me to make a blessing every time I eat? Well, Friday night, once a week, a blessing. Good enough. You want me to go ahead and put a mezuzah on every single door in my house? I have 25 doors. I have to buy 25 mezuzahs? Inconvenient. Better probably be Christian. Easier. That's showing it's not convenient. There's another way of showing it's not convenient. The Torah is so holy. It's so pure. I can't bring this pure Torah into my home.
No, I'm going to leave it here. I'm going to stay here. I'm not going to go home. Home is impure. I'm going to stay here. Rav Chaim Drukman used to say at the end of Yom Kippur, it's not a big deal to be an angel on Yom Kippur. You don't eat, you don't drink, you don't wear leather shoes like angels. You know what the real test is? Are you going to eat like a mensch after Yom Kippur? That's the test. Are you going to be a human being when you go home? Same thing here. You want to show the Torah is relevant to your entire life? Not just the synagogue, not just to the study hall? Let's see you plug it into what you do at home. Then you say, it's convenient. The Torah is not just for the synagogue. I use it at home. In the way I eat, in the way I drink, in the way I conduct business, in the way I do everything. And if it's inconvenient, then indeed, once a year, once a week, once a day, whatever it might be, you give it a little attention because it's inconvenient for you to take it home. You know, this is mitzvah upon the king to have a Sefer Torah. Every Jew should write a Sefer Torah. Does that apply today? Do we fulfill it with Jewish books? A different lecture. A king has to write 2 Sefer Torah. When he's a regular Jew and then he becomes a king, he has to write a Torah and he has to hold it, says the Torah, in his hands all his life. As long as he's king, until he resigns his kingship, he has to hold the Torah. Now, can you tell me how he's supposed to do that? How, in God's name, is he supposed to hold a big Torah like this his entire life? The man won't have a hand. It will be totally paralyzed. Imagine you hold the Torah, not just for the Haftorah, not just for the prayer for the welfare of the state. You're holding it your entire life. Anyone know how he does that? So they had a convenient way. They didn't write a big Sefer Torah we read from. It's not one you put in the Ark of the Ark. What do? A little Sefer Torah. He had a rubber band, tied it around his elbow. He went around with it all the time. It was convenient. Take the entire teachings of the Torah. Are they convenient and acceptable, or are they inconvenient and unacceptable? If they're inconvenient and unacceptable, then once a year, twice a year, once a week, whenever you choose, you'll look at it, you'll kiss it, you'll say, holy, holy it is. And then you'll say bye-bye, like the guy said when he left shul, bye God, I'll see you next year. And you go home and you say, it's inconvenient for my home, it's inconvenient for my life, it's inconvenient for me. I don't want anything to do with it, I don't want it to bother me. What's the litmus test? On Shavuos. Will you be able, on the day God gave the Torah, to eat and to drink and to talk and not violate one Jewish law? Is that possible? Then the Torah is convenient and acceptable. Impossible? We got a problem. Therefore, it's extremely important that on the day that God gave us the Torah, we do not make a big deal about the Torah. Rather, it's an anniversary of us making a big deal about the Torah when? All year, every day, all the time. In the way we wait in line in a queue, in the way we get upset, in the way we draft emails, in the way we write letters, in the way we do everything. Are we going to do it in a dignified Torah fashion, in accordance with the laws of the Torah, or is it void of the Torah? And ultimately, if you ask me, what is the mission of the Ark in general? And all the beautiful people that come through this door saying we want to come back to Judaism, in particular, come to Judaism, it is exactly this test. Namely, are we going to make the Torah convenient and acceptable and relevant to everything we do? Or we're just going to look at it, think of it, see it's holy, and have nothing to do with it. The Ark Center, from its inception, basically said anything we do in life could be put into Judaism. If it can't, it has no place in the synagogue. But if it can, it has a place in a synagogue. So therefore, this center doesn't just have a synagogue. It has this room. It has other rooms. There's many activities going on here. And every one of them, you could say, oh, this is another thing in the Torah. That's another Torah value. That's a mitzvah. That's a value. That's something that's important. It's not just the synagogue. Namely, I'll give you a simple example. How come I have a real glass in my hands? And you're looking at me saying, well, what do you want to do? Drink out of the bottle? That's not nice. A little dignity, Rabbi. I know you're Israeli, but okay. Come on. You're in Australia. Act like an Australian. A little dignity. Why do I have a real glass in my hand? Correct. Now I'm going to buttress my question. In many synagogues, they have a problem. No one wants to wash the dishes. So what do?
They have a great idea. They buy disposables. They throw out disposables like crazy. Not here. Why? Because in this synagogue, they know that if indeed we have a problem of global warming, and indeed we have a problem with the ozone layer, and indeed all this is a challenge, then the first place we practice it is here. And the last thing we want to do is have disposables that are only ruining the ozone layer and contributing to global warming even more. Now, don't mix me up with the facts. Even if I'm wrong, you have to admit that was a good one.
These are recyclable.
And these are recyclable. Namely, and I know this for a fact because I asked the first time I came, because it's very rare to find this in a synagogue, that even in a function on a Wednesday night, there's real glass dishes that you have to wash. And the answer was, we care about the ozone layer here. What do you mean? Torah's limited to Shabbos and kosher food? God created a world. Don't we have to keep it? If we don't keep the world, it's like saying, God, thank you for creating the world. We're not interested. Imagine getting a birthday present and you say, no thanks, don't want it. So the first place to practice it is here. We should be at the forefront, not at the back front. Let's go on. Upstairs is a room of toys. Why is there a room of toys?
For kids.
For kids. Why do kids need to come to synagogue?
To make it a fun place for them.
And one second, they don't. They don't need to come. They're not bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah yet. When they get older and know how to daven a little, yes, but not now. They're little kids, 6, 5, 4, 3. Why are there toys upstairs?
So parents can come, and the kids can play, and hopefully they'll be supervised.
So basically, says Michael, that the reason why there's toys upstairs is to ensure that parents come, and there's no excuse for parents not to come because there's proper toys upstairs, and it's fun for kids, and it's good for parents. Everyone gets something. In other words, the synagogue, the Ark, the way I understand it, said we're not just a place to daven, we're a place that welcomes in the family. You want to welcome in a family? This is the way to do it. You have toys for the kids, and you have prayer books for the adults. You don't just have prayer books for the adults. Where are the kids supposed to be? Oh, I don't know. And then you have someone going around the synagogue, always there's someone in every synagogue, shh, shh, shh. It's like you're on the motorway. Jeff, I told you, don't mix me up with the facts.
Don't do it all the time.
Okay, Jeff, I never saw you do that. I was here many times. I saw this synagogue receiving Shabbos. Kids are jumping on the bima backwards and forwards. No one hushes them. Everyone's okay with it. And the truth of the matter is, that's if we in this synagogue preach the Jewish family, family's important, Jewish family, why does it stop at the synagogue? There, all of a sudden, family's not important. Kids, not wanted. Only people allowed into the synagogue are people that are mammals that breathe and keep quiet. That's it. If you make noise, out. So I understand, Jewish family is important up until the place where you hear about it, in the Torah reading. They're not important. So the rabbi's talking about how important the Jewish family is in his sermon, and at the same time you got five hushers hushing out the kids. Does that make sense to anyone? Now it happens in many synagogues. Here it doesn't happen. Because here, we want to show the Torah is convenient and acceptable. So if family's family, then we're going to make sure that family's welcome. Family is welcome. So if family's welcome, there's toys and there's prayer books. Let's go on. We're walking through the Ark Center now. Anyone didn't know what's in this building? We'll continue. Okay, this is what you're paying a lease for. Okay? You got toys, one room. You have a synagogue in another room. Let's continue. What do you have when you walk into the Ark Center? You walk in, welcome to the Ark Center. What do you have? The first thing you see. You know, looks count, and first impressions count even more. I teach my rabbis in training. You go into an interview. If you come in the first 5 seconds, not dressed beautifully, I mean, your shirt is not ironed perfectly, don't go to the interview. You come in talking on your phone. That's it. 5 seconds, the guy says, I don't want him. First impressions count. What's the first impression? You come into the Ark.
The reception.
The reception area. What's in the reception area?
Couches.
Now let me ask you, how many synagogues do you know in the world? You come in and there's couches with magazines.
There's magazines.
There's magazines. Take a look.
It's not a new idea.
You walk in, there's a reception, I got that. That's not a given because most places don't have a reception. A synagogue doesn't have a reception. There's a lobby and there's prayer books, which are very scary for people that don't know Hebrew. And there's chumashim,
The five books of Moses is even scarier for the people that don't know what it's all about. Big, heavy. And if you have an English translation, that it's even scarier than the scariest. Why? Because if it's Hebrew, at least it's Chinese, I don't understand. If it's a translation in English, a person like me that came to Israel when he was 11 gets very, very upset. You know why? I don't understand the English. Why can't they write a translation? God, Vayomer Hashem Moshe Limor. It doesn't say God said to Moshe. God forbid that should say that. What does it say? And thou said to thee that those should go over there and thou over here. Why can't it be written in proper English that we all talk? It's always written in English, no one understands. So you feel ultra bad. The Hebrew you don't understand, and then the English, your mother tongue, you don't understand. That's not very welcoming. What does the Ark have? Couches. Because you want to feel comfortable in a synagogue. You want Judaism to be comfortable. So the first thing you see is the couches. Yes, eventually you'll get up the ramp. You'll go into the room with the books, those Hebrew books, and the bima, and the ark, and you'll need a little bit of a beginner service. This is a bima, this is an ark, etc. But when you first come in, anyone can feel comfortable because there's magazines and couches. Now, do you have trash on those magazines? Do you go out and buy the most trashiest magazines full of gossip? There's the Jewish news. Okay, a little gossip. But not bad. You got to know what's happening in the Jewish news. There's the Ark news. There's the Jewish news. Come in, have a seat. You come in on Rosh Hashanah. What do you have? What's the first thing you see? Welcome to the Ark Center. We're happy you're here. As the security guards outside don't scare you, you go in. What do you see? Do you still do this today? Or this is gone? I made this famous. I always said the one place in the world. If you stopped it, then we're going to have to start it again. Because there's about 25 rabbis doing it, all saying there's a place in Melbourne doing it. So you better not mix me up with the fact. What do you see?
Front door by the rabbi.
You walk in, there's bottles of water. Yes. And there's apples. What does that tell you? Water, that doesn't scare me. I know how to drink water. You know how easy it is to take water, make a bracha, shahakol, niyebit varo, and drink it? That's pretty simple as Judaism goes. Showing that the Torah is convenient and acceptable. Then you walk into the shul and you see the stuff that you need a little bit of a beginner service on. Namely, you need to know what a machzor is and what a Torah reading is. And that's provided in many shuls. But first, make everything part of Judaism. From what you read on couches, to what you drink, to what you eat, to how you eat it, disposable cups or not, to family being welcome, and I can go on and on and on. But that's basically what this center is all about. It's not about just limiting us to the holy and the stuff that we do that no one understands and we don't want to go near it and it's too holy for us to touch. But rather, it's a place that's so inclusive, not of just of people, but of Judaism, of the Torah. And if it stops being inclusive of the Torah and Judaism, it's no longer a Jewish center. It's a nice center, it is, but a Jewish center it's not. Namely, if you start limiting and saying, we don't need toys upstairs, forget about it. What do we need kids for? They always make noise. We don't need couches. You have to help the couches. You know how hard it is to clean couches, let's be honest. Let's get rid of the couches. Most synagogues don't have couches. That's fine. Let's get rid of the magazines. We need a subscription to the Jewish news. We can get it online. And you start chiseling away at everything I just said, and we'll use disposables like everyone else. Then unfortunately, the Torah becomes limited to a very few minutes of your life. The 2 hours of the service, the 1 hour of the service, and that's it. If Judaism is indeed something that encompasses our entire life, it's everything we do. And that's what I believe this center has tried to do. And when this center started conversions, that's exactly what they told every single convert. If you want to make your life a life of Torah, namely, everything you do will be part of the Torah, from the way you drive to the way you eat, welcome aboard, we're happy to help you. If you want to limit your Torah to a few ceremonies during the year, this is not the place. We don't do that here. And that's ultimately what our challenge is today. So going back to the beginning of the class, should we invest in the Jewish home or should we invest in the Jewish synagogue? Where should our investment be? Both. Why?
Each parent is important to their heart.
Correct. If there's 10 commandments with 613 divided into them, and there's rabbinic commandments, and there's good customs of the Jewish people, your cheesecake, then ultimately this center has to celebrate it all. They can't start picking and choosing. We do this, we don't do that. Absolutely unacceptable. And if it's difficult, you're right, it's difficult. It's very difficult. You think it's easy to put on a kiddush that's healthy?
That's hard. It's much easier. You buy a few cakes. You go to my favorite place in Melbourne. This is where a lot of business is on. Glick's. You buy yourself a few cakes. Good. You can eat cake. It's fine. Not too much. Not too little. But you want to make a healthy kiddush in moderation. There's cake and there's also cholent and there's also tomatoes and salad. Wow, it becomes, you know what, forget it. Cake, kugel, herring, done deal, few disposables. You got yourself your kiddush. God bless you. You want to cut up fruit because they're healthy? That takes a lot of time. You want to have vegetables because this is even healthier upon healthier. No sugar? Whoa, too much. That's exactly what we can't do, to say the word too much. There is no too much. If we can't say that what we do in this room and in that room and in the room next door is part of Judaism, we shouldn't have these rooms. But if it is, thank God we have many rooms. And my hope and prayer is that this Ark Center will continue to have more and more rooms because Judaism continues to flourish to such an extent that there won't be any room left. You'll just need to make more and more rooms. No, the rent won't go up, God forbid. But more and more activity will be done as more and more mitzvot get celebrated in this beautiful center. Thank you all very much for listening. Any questions you have, I'm open to anything in the world, please. I can't promise answers, but I can definitely hear the questions. See, God gave me 2 ears and one mouth, and he was trying to give me a hint. Hear more than you speak. For the last hour, I didn't do that, so I'm happy to hear questions.
I have one question.
Yes.
It's an easy question. You have a quote on your last page.
Yes.
The one that says one should rejoice in food and drink.
Yes.
Who said it? Who gave that?
The one that said you should rejoice in food and drink is Rashi.
That is Rashi.
It's working off the Medrash of our sages, but yes, it's Rashi.
Good.
It says Rashi a bit on top here, yeah.
I like Rashi.
I should have put Rashi on the sides there, just in case you forget. Rashi. Yes, any other questions about anything? It doesn't have to be about this class, it's fine. You want to talk about his politics, you want to talk about prime ministers, anything. It's not the politics of Israel, it's July of 2019. I'm not so happy with the politics of Israel at this moment when there was elections and there's another election. It's not the best point in my life. So outside of that issue, anything else?
The question that you didn't want to talk about at the beginning in terms of the life of study versus the life of contributing to society.
I think I was a good joke, no? Based on my class, what's the answer? How can you say that army service is not part of Torah life? Army service and contributing to Israeli society is not only part of life, but first of all, we just proved in this class everything is part of Judaism. If not, what are you doing it for? If you're working for a living, having an honest living, of course, and providing for your family, that is absolutely a mitzvah. You actually signed a ketubah to your wife saying, I will support my wife, which meant I would support my family. Absolute mitzvah. But let's take it a step further. When you're in Melbourne, Australia, New York, USA, London, England, or London, Ontario, or Vienna, or Munich, or Berlin, and you're doing what you're supposed to do, everything we just said here, that's wonderful. If you're doing it in Israel, you get an additional mitzvah. You know what that's called? If I'm sitting in Israel and I'm looking at my phone, you know, going through the phone, Facebook, Instagram, what am I doing? Mitzvat Yeshuv Haaretz. I am doing a mitzvah from the Torah of settling the land. How do you settle the land of Israel? It doesn't mean that you come to Israel, you sit down, oh, I settled, all right, what's next? Settled in the land of Israel means that you live there and you function there. So if you're in Israel, and you're a doctor, a lawyer, a CPA, an accountant, computer technician, you are fulfilling two mitzvot. Number one, you're earning an honest living, important. Number two, you're fulfilling the mitzvah of settling in the land of Israel. So if you ask me about that particular debate in Israel, I don't understand the debate because the very question I don't understand, the assumption of the question is that there's these pure individuals that need to learn Torah all the time and the rest of us are not pure. You just learned it right here. Anything we do is part of Torah. Do you know how the Israeli army, the IDF, would change if more Torah Jews would go into it? You'd have more honesty. You'd have less cursing, less foul language. I can go on and on with things I saw in the army as a soldier.
that I say more Israeli soldiers, less of this. Many people around the world say we're not moving to Israel because of this politician or that politician. I always say to them, that's very nice to say. Move to Israel. Your ballot is your bullet. You want to change things, move there and change them. You want to change the Israeli army because it's not conducive to a religious lifestyle? Go in. Change. Show how you can get upset and not curse. Show. Show how you can talk to girls with dignity. Show how you can go ahead, keep Shabbos, keep Yom Tov, keep this, keep that, and at the same time be an amazing soldier. And people will look at you and say, wow, if a person with a kippah does that, all the more so me. If you, on the other hand, want to limit your Torah to your community, to your study hall, everything we said here tonight, everything we said, just turn it over. The Torah should be once a year, it should be pure, we shouldn't touch it, we should leave it in the synagogue, we shouldn't look at it. Do respect. You don't look at the Kohen's hands when he duchens. Absolutely. You look at the Torah all the time. So I hope I answered that question subtly throughout the class. Yeah.
If the Torah students go into the army, and God forbid there is a war, are they going to put down their guns and pick up their siddurs on Shabbat and say, I cannot fight?
Absolutely not. It's against Jewish law to do that. Did I answer the question? Okay. Life endangering, not from my perspective. No. This is not my perspective. The most ultra-religious Jew to the most light religious Jew will answer the same answer I just gave. Life overrides religion. Everyone knows that. That's ABCs of Judaism. In pre-1K or in Kindy or what do you call Kresh? You call it Kresh here, right?
Yeah.
I'm always, every country has a different name for that age. In America, it's called nursery.
Yeah.
Okay. In Canada, it's called primary. Okay? Okay, here it's called Kresh. Different names, same thing. They teach you. There's one thing that overrides religion. There's one thing that overrides Yom Kippur.
Life.
So everyone's going to answer the same question.
Answer.
That's not. In a war, you put down your Gemara, you put down your Siddur, you put down your Tefillin, and you go out to fight. Everyone agrees. No one's going to say no. In the most ultra-religious neighborhood in Jerusalem, where they're against Zionism, against everyone, against the world, they don't want to see people that are not religious, let alone, God forbid, anything that's not pure. If on someone on Shabbos, a woman, not dressed modestly, has a heart attack, the ambulance goes out and takes care of her.
I understand that.
That's a given. That's a given. The question is not when there's a war. The question is right before the war. We want to prevent a war. We don't want a war. We don't want a war with our enemies. That's a necessity. No one wants to fight in a war. We want to prevent the war. You know what that's called in Hebrew? We have a new term in Hebrew. It's called batash. Anyone ever heard that? Oh, if you're not, anyone here serving the Israeli army? Okay, I have to give a little 5-second introduction. In the Israeli army, everything goes by abbreviations. If you don't live in the army, you don't understand the word they're saying. The map went to the shmap and went up to the kamak. No one knows what you're talking about. When you get into the army, every abbreviation is said. No one talks normal language. Batash, bitachon, shotef, regular security. What's regular security? Regular security means like this. When is the service here Friday night? Rabbi, 5:45, 6 o'clock? What's outside the door? Batash, security. Does he have a thing in his ear? Okay, does he have a gun?
No.
Okay, let's say he gets on Friday a warning they're about to attack a Jewish synagogue in Melbourne. So now you're going to have not one security guard outside, you're going to have about 5 policemen outside, all armed. One of them's a Jew. His name is, let's just call him a name. His name is Jesse. You know, a Jesse is a Jew, he has a gun. And Jesse's out there with his gun. Friday night, outside the synagogue, when anyone here in this room say, Jesse, you're not allowed to carry on Shabbos, why are you holding a gun? There's no Eruv at this part of Melbourne. Yeah, why are you carrying a gun? Absolutely not. Batash, you want to prevent these people from coming in and blowing up your synagogue? Absolutely, you carry your gun, you do patrols, you do what you need to do. Everyone would agree with that. Everything I just said. There's no difference of opinion. The difference of opinion begins as follows. Do we need to go ahead and train Torah students to do what I just said? Or no, the Torah students will fight in the war. But outside of war, the Torah students are too pure to be in the unpure army. That's where it starts.
But everyone agrees, if a war is a war, everyone goes out. What, if Friday night, Yom Kippur, there's no difference of opinion on that. That's the question that's now part of the political scene in Israel, allegedly, by one party, who made trouble and said this is the main issue. It's not a main issue anymore, but quite frankly, he made it into an issue. And I'll tell you honestly, I don't see it as an issue for me. My son, who's 18, who can make his own decision, doesn't see it as an issue for him. He's combining Torah studies with going into the army. But there are people that see it as an issue. Based on my talk tonight, I don't understand where the issue begins. We're not talking about going into the secular army in Russia where the Tsar decides to start a war for no reason, you know, for kicks. It says one day I'm bored, nothing good on TV, let's start a war. We're talking about when there's a necessity to fight for your life of Jewish souls living in the Jewish homeland. The question is, the step before, do you go in and serve your time? So that when and if there's a war, you're there at the forefront, just like you're at the forefront of recycling and the forefront of other things. Or no. I once knew a great Rebbe. He's a wonderful man. I think I learned how to daven from him. I've been told I daven like him. I don't know what he's a Rebbe of. He has no real Hasidim, but he was a Rebbe. He looked like a Rebbe, a Hasidic Rebbe. When I grew up, he was the family Rebbe. We called him, he looked like a Rebbe, he smelled like a Rebbe, he sweat like the Rebbe, he was the Rebbe. Okay, he wore a strimel. You know what a strimel is? Okay, for a hat. Very nice man. I have nothing against him personally. Really, nothing. But the following episode happened. I have to share this with you. As I said, my father, Areni Kaparat Mishkavol, died this year. So, you know, by definition, when you're in the year of mourning, a lot of memories come up. Memories from years ago that you've sort of forgotten, and they come to the forefront of your mind. So this I can't forget. Shalosh Shudos on Shabbos. The third meal of Shabbos is usually eaten as Shabbos is beginning to go away. There's even a song, Shabbos is going away, I forgot the rest of it, that you sing at Shalosh Shudos in English. Very nice song. So this Rebbe is sitting at the Shalosh Shudos table. And it's in his little synagogue. And he says the following, I just heard the most dumbest idea today. A guy said he's making Aliyah. So this was a Rebbe I said without Hasidim. So usually when a Rebbe talks, no one talks back to a Rebbe. Holy. These are not Hasidim. Rabbi, what's the matter with that? He's moving to Israel. It's a mitzvah. So wait. I didn't say that was dumb. That's a good idea. You can move to Israel. You should have a good life. Fine. We'll have one day of the holiday, not two. That's fine. But he told me, I asked him, what are you going to do in Israel? How are you going to make a living? See, this was a time in the 80s where if you move to Israel, the idea was you're never going to make a living. It's like you live in Israel, you don't eat. You don't sleep, you don't eat, there's nothing. When we made Aliyah to Israel in 1988, they told my parents on the way to the airport, there's no washing machines in Israel, right? There's no refrigerators in Israel, right? This is what we were told as we were getting encouraged to get on that El Al plane. Okay? That's why I don't take El Al.
It's the same
food
today.
Yeah, yeah.
It's probably got the same dates.
Now I get to the punchline. He said, I heard the dumbest idea today. I said, what are you going to make a living from? And the Rebbe said, he said to the Rebbe, I'm going into Tzva Keva. I'm going to be a career soldier. I said, what do you mean a career soldier? When there's a war, you go and you fight. Got that? Why do you make a career out of the army? When there's a war, you take a gun, you go fight. My father, Hareni Kaparat Mishkavol, sitting there at blessed memory, looks the Rebbe right in the eye. Never forget this. And says, Rebbe, see, I forgot this for 30. All of a sudden, came back to me during the shiva. Rebbe, let me ask you a question. Tomorrow there's a war in Israel. And you're going to go fight, right? Right. You get into an F-16 and fly it? You know what, Rebbe, I'll go a step behind. Can you take an Uzi? Then the Uzi. Remember the Uzi? The Uzi, this was like, this, whoa, an Uzi. An Uzi is so heavy, it's terrible. I say that as a soldier, okay? It's a terrible gun. But you're going to take an Uzi. You know how to shoot it? Sure, you press the button, you shoot. Okay, let me ask you a question. Right? I give you an Uzi after Shabbos. I'm going to tell you, here's the target. Go, shoot. You're going to shoot right in the middle? You need to practice until you shoot it. You get into an F-16 plane, and you're going to fly it and bomb on the Six-Day War, and that's it? Within 2 hours, Egyptian army finished? You need to practice. You need to practice and practice for that day when hopefully will never come that you'll need to do it. But without practice, due respect, how are you going to fight? So I don't understand when people say, oh, if it's a life-endangering situation, we're there. But in Till then, we don't need to be there. How are you going to be there if you don't know what to do? So the guy said, the guy gets a heart attack, I'll violate Shabbos. So that's very nice. Did you learn how to resuscitate someone when someone gets a heart attack? Or you never learned that. So when you see someone who goes, oh my gosh, and he falls down, you have no idea what to do other than look. You know, the guy's not breathing over here. What am I supposed to do? Every minute, every second you think, more brain cells are dying. I don't understand where that particular argument gets off the ground, because if you don't learn how to fight, how are you going to fight? So what you do when at 18 you enlist into the Israeli army, as I did, as a citizen of Israel, as the law requires, and I have to admit, as a Torah obligation, the way I see it, but you can disagree on that last point, was to go ahead and say, on that day, when there's a war, I'm ready to fight, because I learned how to use a gun. And in my case, I was in the part of the army that they put the semi-quasi-combat soldiers. This is like the combat soldiers minus. That was me. You know what that is? This is not the paratroopers here. Not even the tanks. What's one step behind the paratroopers and the tanks? There's a picture of me at home. I always tell my kids, this is the most dangerous soldier in the Israeli army. It's me on the ground, flat, with a gun, helmet on. I said, this was the most dangerous soldier in the Israeli army. When he shot a gun, no one was around. They ran for the hills. No, it wasn't, actually. I almost got killed the first time they did target practice, not for myself. Next to me was a guy who was Russian, knew a little Hebrew. Now, when you went to do target practice at the real magazine, they taught you that the worst thing you can do, I mean, like, this is the height of danger, is don't move your gun to the sides, because who's on the sides?
Other people.
So, anyone in the Israeli army knows that you hold the gun straight. You walk in straight. You lay down straight. How do you lay down straight without moving the gun? I don't know, if you tell me to lay down now, take my gun, I'll put it over here, and I'll lay down. So how do you lay down straight? They teach you how to lay down with one hand. And I can do it to this day, okay? It's called the pazatzta, if anyone wants to know the Israeli term. I don't know what that stands for. It's also an abbreviation. Okay, so a guy next to me, his name is Simcha, he comes in. The poor guy knew Russian and a little Hebrew, and he didn't get that law. So, you get in, everything's fine, you walk in, he went down on the ground, and they said, cock your gun. Okay. He says, dear commander, I can't cock it. And he points the gun right at me. It's loaded. It's loaded. The gun is loaded. How come he couldn't cock the gun? It was already cocked. I mean, if he pressed the trigger, I wouldn't be here tonight. Or I'd be here handicapped. I'd be here. Okay? Now, I almost got shot. Not by myself, but that. I say, this is the most dangerous soldier in the Israeli army. He was in Tot Chanim. My kids start cracking up. They say, Tot Chanim. That's like a combat soldier that just made it. You know the Frisco kid? Of the 90 students that finished ordination, you barely made 91. So that's infantry, where I was in. I was in the infantry unit. But if I was in the infantry unit, there was a war, you know what my job would be? To shoot a gun? Got it. I learned how. You know what an infantry unit does? It's like a cannon. Okay, it's like a tank, but you're 20 kilometers behind enemy lines, and you shoot in like the Air Force. And you learn how to shoot in to sort of lay the ground for the forces that are infantry, not the infantry sources, for the soldiers that are on foot to come in and to capture it. That's my job. That's my little job. So I learned how to drive this big tank called, in Hebrew, automat. How do you say it in English? Is there a term? Whatever it is. And you ultimately learn how to use the computer inside and whatnot. You take someone to, oh, there's a war, I'll go fight. You put him in there, he will be the most dangerous soldier in the Israeli army. First of all, he'll shoot everyone around because he won't know how to hold the gun. Second of all, he won't know how to use this thing. Number three is the enemy's going to love this guy. They're going to look, they're going to say, wow, we usually have to pay for a comedian. We're getting it right here. Look at this. He's shooting him. You know how many murders there'll be in the Israeli army if you don't practice? So the bottom line is, I really don't understand the argument, where it begins, where it ends. First of all, the Torah can fit into the army. And Baruch Hashem, thank God, in the Israeli army, they keep Shabbos. In every kitchen, there's an Eruv on every base. They keep Pesach on every base. I just don't understand where it gets off the ground. And number two, even if you say it's not like home, which I admit it's not, then how exactly are you going to fight on that day? I mean, due respect. A doctor has to know what to do with an emergency, so he practices in residency for years. How are you supposed to be that combat soldier if you didn't practice and know how to do it? So therefore, I don't understand. Beyond me, maybe I'm not a Talmudic scholar. My brain is not that developed to understand how you're supposed to fight if you don't know how. So that's not talking about anything in Israel that I didn't want to talk about. Any other questions, please? Okay, it's getting late. So I just want to say that I'll be here till Monday. If you have any follow-up questions, really, with pleasure, I'll be happy to receive them and answer them as soon as I get the time. I want to thank Rabbi Gabi once again for inviting me to address this Wednesday night class, which again brings back beautiful memories. I want to thank you for listening, because I let off a lot of steam, and thank God. You know, usually I have to pay for a psychologist when you all listen, and it's all for free. Thank you so much. And I thank you for coming. Thank you very much. Thank you.